Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Lisa Mullins, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. We will start the hour in Israel, where police say that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu should be indicted for bribery and corruption. That recommendation was made to the country's attorney general after an 18-month probe. Netanyahu called the allegations baseless and said he would remain as prime minister. Neri Zilber is a journalist and researcher at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He joins us from Tel Aviv. Neri, welcome back.
Good to be back, Jeremy.
And there are not charges yet. They could amount to nothing, but what are police recommending?
Well, that's right. What they're basically saying is that there's an evidentiary basis. There's evidence to indict Netanyahu, long-serving Israeli prime minister, on a slew of fraud, breach of trust, and bribery charges. But as you mentioned, it's not legally binding.
And remind us of what the allegations are. There are two big parts of this. Case 1000, which is a gifts for favor allegation.
Right. So there are two major corruption probes. Case 1000. Basically, Netanyahu's relationship, what he terms a friendship, with two rich businessmen. The police allege hundreds of thousands of dollars in gifts, whether cigars, champagne, and even jewelry, in return for certain favors that help these two businessmen and their bottom line. And then Case 2000 is also a favor trading gambit between Netanyahu and a major newspaper publisher here in Israel, essentially the publisher offering to give Netanyahu positive press coverage in return for Netanyahu trying to pass legislation that would help this publisher's precarious bottom line.
So is there any evidence that Netanyahu actually returned the favors?
Well, that's where it gets tricky and where the police allege that there is evidence, both witnesses and actual documentation, to prove that Netanyahu, at the very least, tried to act on these requests. It's open to interpretation, really, whether there's enough evidence to prove that in a court of law. And obviously, Netanyahu himself claims that this is all just a big misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. And now it goes to the Attorney General, who will have to actually decide what to do.
And the Attorney General, by the way, is a one-time Netanyahu staffer, correct?
Correct. So there are various levels to this. So the current Attorney General, a man by the name of Avichai Mandelblit, from all the legal experts I talked to, he actually has a very strong reputation in the legal community as a real legal professional. But in the past, a few years ago, he was Netanyahu's cabinet secretary. And then he was appointed and really handpicked by Netanyahu to be Attorney General. So there are certain public murmurings about whether this individual can really be objective. Most legal professionals believed, you know, that he can be, but he'll really have a tough decision on his hands, you know, starting today.
So Netanyahu addressed the nation last night. What's he saying?
Not surprising, he denied all the allegations against him. And he even went further. He called it a politically motivated witch hunt, brought up certain allegations that he has that have surfaced in the past few weeks about the integrity of the police investigators and their ability to be objective. So really calling into question the entire law enforcement institution that he oversees, not unlike a certain U.S. president right now, perhaps. So really, it's in the public sphere right now, and it seems like the political system is, for the moment, standing with Netanyahu.
Netanyahu's predecessor, Ehud Olmert, announced his resignation in 2008, a week after the police recommended that he be charged with corruption. If Netanyahu were to step down, who would take his place?
Well, there are a multitude, really, of candidates within his own Likud party. For the moment, they're all quiet, and they're all rallying around the party leader. You know, obviously, there's people in the opposition, primarily Yair Lapid. He's the head of a major opposition party. The interesting thing about Lapid is that he's actually a witness in Case 1000. Hmm. I'll just say that Netanyahu, for the moment, doesn't have to go anywhere. This process will take a few more months to play out. Mandelblit has to receive the police cases and what they've gathered. He needs to study it. And then there's a whole slew of other legal procedures that need to take place before he actually decides on whether to indict or not, and crucially, what to indict Netanyahu on.
That's Neri Zilber, who's a journalist and researcher at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, joining us from Tel Aviv. Neri, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
At the Winter Olympics today, the men's hockey tournament opened with a couple of surprises. The U.S. lost to Slovenia 3-2, and Russia fell to Slovakia by the same score. There is no falling, literally, for snowboarder Sean White in the halfpipe. He put the disappointment of not winning a medal 4 years ago in Russia behind him and got a gold medal performance in South Korea. NPR's Melissa Block is in Pyeongchang. And Melissa, Sean White was the last man up. You could feel the tension as he was about to drop into the halfpipe. And he won. How did he do it?
Well, why don't I let him tell you exactly how he did it? He's going to explain it in snowboard speak first, and then we'll try to translate.
I started with the frontside double cork 1440, and then into a cab double cork 1440, into a frontside stalefish 540, a double McTwist 1260, into a frontside double cork 1260. And I won the gold.
It was as easy as that. I don't know what he's talking about, Melissa. Explain it.
Well, he's talking about doing just a series of outrageously complicated spins and jumps. Some of them, two actually back-to-back, four rotations consecutively. And it was a nail-biter. The Japanese snowboarder, Ayumu Hirano, had bested Sean White in the second of three runs, and the winner is determined by the best of the three. So Sean White needed to be spectacular in that last run to win, and he was. He was really almost perfect, 97.75 out of 100. And in winning gold, he earned the 100th U.S. gold medal in the history of the Winter Olympics. He's now 31. He won his first gold at 19.
Wow. And you could feel the tension break after as he was sobbing when he found out he won the gold, gave a huge bear hug to his parents. It was really a wonderful moment. At the press conference afterwards, there was a question about something much more sobering. He had to answer a question about sexual misconduct allegations that were made against him in a 2016 lawsuit. What did he say?
Yeah, this was a lawsuit that was filed by the former drummer in his band, a band called Bad Things. Her name is Lena Zawada. And Sean White agreed to settle that lawsuit last year for an undisclosed amount. She had alleged that he sexually harassed her over several years. And I've read the complaint. It's pretty nasty stuff. She alleges that he texted her graphic, sexually explicit images, which he later did admit sending, that he made her watch disturbing pornographic videos, and a whole series of other harassing behavior, and later that he fired her from his band. She sued for wrongful termination as well as the sexual harassment. And at this news conference, as you say, a reporter did ask Sean White whether he thinks this will tarnish his legacy. Here's what he said.
You know, honestly, here to talk about the Olympics, not, you know, gossip. But I don't think so. I am who I am, and I'm proud of who I am, and my friends love me and vouch for me, and I think that stands on its own.
So he's dismissing it as gossip, Lisa, but again, in this Me Too moment, I think, you know, these allegations obviously get more prominence than they might have in the past.
And getting back to the athletics, there were a lot of weather conditions that the athletes have to worry about. Last night during the halfpipe, a lot of the competitors stood at the top of the hill waiting for the wind to subside so they wouldn't get kind of caught midair in a gusty wind as they were doing the halfpipe. Alpine skiing has been affected as well. How has that been messed up and delayed by the high winds?
Yeah, hugely affected. The winds here are something else, just ferocious winds that this part of South Korea is known for. In alpine skiing, they've had to postpone marquee events, including the men's downhill, the women's giant slalom, and slalom races. In downhill, I should mention that one of the U.S. downhill skiers, Tommy Biesmeier, suffered an ankle injury today in training. So he's out. He will not be competing. And he had a really poignant thing to say. He said, "You're supposed to be optimistic in times like these and say something like, 'I will come back stronger than ever.' but I just can't bring myself to do it. And Lisa, it's not just Alpine. They also had to postpone the women's biathlon event tonight. That's an event that combines cross-country skiing and rifle shooting. It's a really exciting event to watch. Now, tomorrow, things are supposed to die down as far as the wind goes, so those events should go forward.
One more question. You tweeted a picture of tears streaming down the face of the American speed skater Maame Bainey. She was eliminated in the 500-meter quarterfinal. What happened there?
Yeah, there was a lot of expectation riding on her in these events. She's a tremendously powerful, very young skater. She's 18, just turned 18 years old, first African-American woman ever to qualify for a U.S. speed skating team. And she didn't make it out of the quarterfinal. She was last in her heat of four, and you could just see the dejection etched on her face. At the same time, she's known for having this electric smile. Her coach says he's never seen her not smiling, even when she's mad. So she was smiling through tears. It's just one of those moments that makes you realize just how pressure-filled these events are for all of these athletes.
NPR's Melissa Block speaking with us from the Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea. Thank you, Melissa.
You're welcome.
The National Security Agency is tweeting that there is no ongoing safety threat after a shooting at the spy agency's campus in Fort Meade, Maryland this morning. There were no deaths, and a suspect is said to be in custody. NPR's Brakten Booker has been following the story. And Brakten, we're seeing images of a black SUV crashed into one of the gates outside of the very secretive NSA. What do we know about what happened?
Yeah, Jeremy. So details are still coming in at this time. What I can tell you is that shots were fired at the Fort Meade Army installation where the NSA is located. Shortly after 7 a.m. local time, a vehicle tried to enter the NSA, which, of course, is heavily secured. Weapons were discharged during the incident, and several people were taken to the hospital. And I will note that according to NSA public relations, early reports say none of the injuries were a result of the gunfire.
And does it seem to be linked to terrorism?
There are no signs that this is linked to terrorism. As of now, we're hoping to get more information at a press conference at 12:45. What I can tell you, though, is the FBI has taken the lead in the investigation. And I think it's important to note, too, that the NSA statement acknowledges that shots were fired, but it's vague. It does not say whether the shots were fired by the suspect or by law enforcement.
Do we know anything about the suspect?
Not at this time. Not at this time. Details, like I said, are very limited, and there's a press conference coming up at about 12:45 Eastern time.
So what are you going to be watching for as that press conference comes out?
Well, terrorism charges terrorism is something that we are certainly looking to see if law enforcement officials will knock those questions down. And we're also trying to see whether or not this was just somebody who made a wrong turn at the NSA entrance.
It's NPR's Brakten Booker talking with us about the shooting this morning at the NSA in Fort Meade, Maryland. Brakten, thank you.
Thank you.
James Hunter sings the blues and he sings soul, two genres that are steeped in heartache and hard times. James Hunter's latest album sounds like a soul music Valentine because this hardscrabble school dropout from Britain has fallen in love and married a fan from America. James Hunter's album is called Whatever It Takes and was inspired by his wife.
When we met, I was pretty well set in my ways. I didn't care how or where I spent my day.
Hunter is a Grammy nominee. He's topped Billboard's blues chart, and he's about to launch a tour of the U.S. We asked him to a studio in London to talk about his life and listen to his music.
Love you so that all I know is I don't want to be without you, baby, like before. I don't want to be without you, baby, no more.
What did you? I like the way you're grooving to it as you listen to it.
I like the bit before the singing comes in. That's my favourite part.
Really? Why?
Yeah, I know. All that caterwauling always ruins it. I always like the intros better, but you know.
That's pretty funny. So it strikes me when I listen to the album that the whole album seems to be a portrait of your life. Can you describe how this song kind of kicks off the theme of the album?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's all that sort of thing about being happily married. I've got to downplay it because my wife's sitting next to me, so I've got
she is.
I can't get too gooey, you know. Otherwise, she starts taking a mick out of me.
What's your wife's name?
Jessie.
Jessie, can she share the mic with you there?
She's allowed to speak. Does your mic work, or do you want to come
over?
I don't know.
Oh, hello.
Oh, hi, Jessie. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm Lisa. I know you didn't expect to be on, but as we learn about James, I wonder if you can tell us how you met him.
Well, I heard him on the radio in a Starbucks and fell in love with his music and ended up going to a few shows and we became friends and it sort of turned into something else later on.
And it went downhill from there, didn't it?
Yes. Yeah, out of the frying pan into the toilet.
See, I'm learning, huh?
So, James, thank you, Jessie. James, I wonder why you decided not to move to the U.S., but instead that Jessie would move to Brighton.
I think because I have a hard enough time getting through immigration when I don't want to move there. The other thing is there's so many things I dislike about my own country, but I couldn't bear to leave it.
So she's moved over there. That wasn't an easy process.
Not at all.
Yeah, you wrote a song about this. Let's hear the song and then you can tell us a story.
We're one step away from a better day, however long the night, and whatever it takes, I'm gonna make everything all right. Leave the struggle in the past and have a little faith in me. Long as trouble's gonna last, you're gonna be safe with me. I'm gonna make everything.
What did you want Jessie to have faith in you about?
Actually, this was at a time when Jessie was absolutely going through hell. We were trying to get her legal residency in the UK, so she had to fill out all these forms and go to these various departments. But when she'd get there and queue up for 2 hours, she'd be told that was the wrong place, she had to take this there. And she was wandering about with innumerable sheaves of paper. I mean, she looked like a mobile stationer, isn't that right? And you got messed about something rotten. It wasn't straightforward at all.
Jessie, you weren't having second thoughts, were you?
No, I it was the hardest thing I think I've ever went through, but it was worth it, you know. I knew I wanted to be with him no matter what it took, so.
Yeah, see what she did there?
So you did have faith in him, and you're living there now. I wonder, how does this all come out musically in your new album?
Well, I mean, the thing is, if I was having a rotten time of it, I'd still be writing romantic songs, but it's just a coincidence that that the themes of the songs happen to match what's going on.
There's a guitar piece you have on this album. We can hear a little bit of it now, and I want you to tell us about Blisters. First, why the name Blisters? I think I know, but why?
Yep, I think you've guessed it. I think it was just because it sounds good and it sounds like an instrumental, you know, that kind of title. And it's because I played it without a plectrum, just to prove that I could.
You mean without a pick?
Without a pick, yeah. It is more difficult to do that, but you get a more barky kind of sound. There's something you get playing like that. And all my heroes play without picks. Loman Pauling, Johnny Guitar Watson, all of them seem to dispense with the pick. And it's something I always had difficulty with, so I thought I'd give it a crack.
That makes me wonder how it is in the recording studio when you're there. So you're playing, in that case, without a pick. You clearly like the recording that sounds more rough than slick. And I wonder how you direct the process, you know, how you work with sound technicians who have amazingly sophisticated abilities and how you get the sound that you want. I mean, how do you work with them in the studio?
Well, in this particular example of it, generally when you're playing with a guitar, the tendency is to try to avoid spillage because we're all playing in the same room. They try to keep the guitar down to a manageable level so that it won't spill onto the saxes and the drums. But for the sound I wanted, it was a necessity to have the guitar obnoxiously loud to give it that flexibility and that kind of slapback sound. So I kicked up, threw the toys out of the pram, insisted on having it horribly loud, and the result was exactly the way I wanted it.
And on this album, it's live to tape or live to 8-track?
When you're playing live, you get a better feel of what each other are doing. If you did it layer by layer, there's nothing for the people who go in first to record. There's nothing for them to react to. If we're live, and I'll do a funny little thing on guitar, Jono can sort of react to it musically. You know, he can throw something in to accentuate it.
And what about putting it down on tape, on 8-track?
Oh, on tape, I think you get that nice hissing sound that you don't get on digital.
Sounds like it's more fun, too, for you.
It is, watching that little thing flick around. You know.
Very nice to talk to you and to Jesse as well. Soul singer, guitarist, and songwriter James Hunter joining us from London. He just released his 6th album called Whatever It Takes. Thank you so much, James.
Thank you.
If you wanted to know, you can't live without her. Words can be heard, but the action speaks louder. So show her.
This is Here and Now.
Show her, don't tell her, that's the only way she'll know if your love is true. Yeah, yeah. Ask any lover who has a practical mind. Demonstration beats conversation every time. So show her.
What does it take to start something from nothing? And what does it take to actually build it? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on How I Built This, I speak with founders behind some of the most inspiring companies in the world. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
In recent weeks, fears of inflation have been roiling the stock market, and today those worries got a little bit worse. The government released its Consumer Price Index and showed inflation is running hotter than most economists had thought. Joining us is NPR's Marilyn Giewax. Marilyn, what caused consumer prices to head up in January, and what is costing us more?
Everything. That's the thing that was sort of surprising in this report. It showed that for the month of January, the consumer price index was up about 0.5%. And that's, you know, more than economists were thinking because everything was up. Rent, gasoline, clothes, food. They weren't huge spikes, but it was so across the board that it frightens people who are worried about general inflation. We've gotten used to seeing inflation run well below 2%, and this report shows that the annual rate is now 2.1%, and it feeds these fears of inflation.
So this is a report on prices. What do we know about wages and whether or not they're keeping pace?
Well, we got a report earlier this month. That one was from the Labor Department saying that the wages were up nearly 3% in January compared with last year. So, yes, paychecks are getting bigger. And some economists say that, you know, we've got those federal tax cuts coming and there will be government spending increases before the year's over. So employers will be competing for workers and that competition could push those wages even a little higher.
But is that good news? I mean, one would think it would be for the American worker who's overdue for some raises.
Yeah. You know, I mean, if you haven't had a raise in a while, you could be thinking, this is the problem I wanted. Give me a raise. But, you know, when employers have to raise wages, they also might have to increase their prices. You've been seeing that especially at restaurants, you know, in places where they've raised the minimum wage. So there's this worry that competition for workers are going to push up wages. That'll lead to higher prices. That'll lead to higher interest rates. And Bingo, there you are. You're back to an inflationary spiral. And if you are old enough to remember anything about the 70s, you know that inflation can really wreck your economy.
So tell us more about that. Is a painful period of inflation inevitable this year?
Well, it does hurt, especially if you're on a fixed income. So you don't want to see those higher prices. But the historical average for inflation is a little over 3%. So even the current rate is still really low. And there's a big difference from what happened in the 1970s. Then we were seeing oil prices zooming up. Everything was getting more expensive. But today, oil supplies are really pretty abundant. And actually, the prices started falling again lately. On GasBuddy, you know, that website that tracks prices, they said the national average for gasoline actually fell by 3.5 cents this week. It's down to $2.50 a gallon. That's really not that bad. And a lot of commodity prices are down. You ask any dairy farmer up there, they've seen these big price drops this year. In fact, milk is supposed to drop for the third year in a row. So a lot of commodities are down.
Could you give us just the bigger picture in closing here? I mean, where the economy stands right now with the backdrop of what's happening on Wall Street and with these new figures?
What we know right now is that the economy is, in general, doing pretty well. A lot of people are hiring. Wages are heading up. The fear that is out there is that we'll see wages and prices going up too fast, and that will drive up interest rates too fast. So they're just trying to come up with this Goldilocks economy where it's not too hot, not too cold. And right now the fear is maybe it's a little too hot.
NPR senior business editor Marilyn Giwax. Marilyn, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
All this week, we're talking about China's trillion-dollar global infrastructure initiative known as Belt and Road. Yesterday, we heard from Kazakhstan, a major crossroads for freight traffic across Asia.
When I landed, basically, it was only desert. It was what we called at that time the middle of nowhere. 3 years later, we can witness a huge development of infrastructures.
Today, we're going to look at Europe, where Chinese shipping companies are buying up ports to reshape trade routes. Frans-Paul van der Putten is a senior research fellow at the Klingendahl Institute in the Netherlands. He joins us from The Hague via Skype. Frans-Paul, where in Europe does China have projects that could be considered part of Belt and Road right now?
Well, it's not always entirely clear which projects are one belt, one road, and which aren't. But in general, those projects that are clearly related to infrastructure and international transport, those could be considered Belt and Road projects. I think the most important ones are located in the Mediterranean countries and in the central and eastern countries of Europe.
Well, give us an example. And I wonder also what China gets out of that investment.
Sure. Well, I think you could say the flagship Belt and Road project that China has in Europe at the moment is in the Greek port of Piraeus. So it's the main Greek seaport, has been bought by a Chinese state-owned company in 2016. And this Chinese company has been investing a lot of money in the port, especially in the container port, to modernize it. And as a result, this Greek port has been growing very fast.
And does China control what comes in and out of the port? Do they get a discount on shipping Chinese goods? Is there some payback for China?
I don't think it works like that. I think any goods can be Chinese or non-Chinese that go through the port. I think it strengthens the position of this particular Chinese company. The name of the company is Cosco. It also strengthens Chinese influence in Greece as a country.
What is Greece getting out of it?
Well, Greece, the port of Piraeus used to be not a very prominent European seaport, but now it's growing very fast. It's already the third largest European Mediterranean seaport. Cosco has expressed the ambition to turn it into the largest Mediterranean seaport. And that means that increasingly, you know, trade between China and Europe increasingly is making use of Greece as an entry or exit point for the European Union.
So you say that there are ports, there are rail lines. What other projects are there?
Well, at the moment, it's still mainly ports and rail lines. If you look at the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative on a global scale, it's not so much about Europe. It's mainly Chinese banks providing loans for infrastructure development, especially in Asia and in Africa. What we see in Europe is like this example we just discussed, the Piraeus port, which already exists, but then China is expanding and modernizing it. And another project that we see is the financing and building of a railway between the capital of Hungary, Budapest, and the capital of Serbia, Belgrade. But this is another big project, but it hasn't yet really materialized. So it's still the new railway is still to be constructed.
Is there skepticism in Europe about this Chinese investment?
Yes, there is. I would say especially at the level of the European Union. I would say there are several concerns. One is that Chinese investments in countries like Hungary and Greece contribute to pre-existing tensions between those member states and the European Union. And another concern is that Chinese investments in countries like, for instance, Serbia or other Western Balkan countries, which are not members of the European Union, create large debts for those countries. And eventually, at some point in the future, when they do become member states of the European Union, they will still have those large debts. And so there will be financial burdens that then may also have a negative impact on the European Union as a whole.
The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, was just in China signing business deals between the UK and China ahead of her country's departure from the European Union. And she said they're forging a bilateral trade agreement and entering a golden era of economic relations between the two countries. Let's listen.
The UK is preparing to leave the European Union. We're seizing the opportunity to become an ever more outward-looking global Britain, deepening our trade relations with nations around the world, including China.
How significant is the UK's apparent embrace of China?
It's interesting that the embrace by the UK of China was actually more obvious or more evident before the Brexit referendum occurred. It's still there. And it's of course, natural that in the post-Brexit phase, they are looking at strengthening their trade relations with non-EU partners. And China, obviously, is a major partner also because the financial sector is such a big part of the British economy. And China is a very important player in the global financial sector, increasingly.
So what are you looking ahead to next? We've got railway projects, port projects. Do you think that this is just the beginning of a bigger role for One Belt, One Road in Europe?
Yes, absolutely. And it's not so much the individual projects. I mean, this will continue. There will be more direct train connections between European cities and Chinese cities. There will be more airline connections between Europe and China. There will be more Chinese investment and involvement in European ports. All this will increase. But I think the biggest impact eventually for Europe will be that Chinese companies, and these are often Chinese state-owned companies, will have an increasing influence on international transport corridors. And therefore, the Chinese government increasingly will be able to have an influence on global trade patterns. And this means that the position of Europe in the international or in the global economy will therefore be affected in a way that is increasingly influenced by Chinese actors, and less so by European governments and European companies.
Now, in China, the phrase One Belt, One Road harkens back to ancient history and China's historical connections to Europe through the original Silk Road. Is there any of that sense of historical pride about this in Europe?
No, I don't think that. I think this appeals more to the probably to the Chinese side than to the European side. But I think the Europeans should look at it from a different perspective. So you could say the first phase that has occurred was that Europeans were not really aware of this Chinese initiative and were not really aware of the major importance. And now we have entered sort of a second phase where people are looking at China and are thinking, okay, this is interesting. It can be big, but it's a Chinese initiative. So let's wait and see what China comes up with. But I think it would be good if European governments, European companies, and also the general public in Europe would look at it more in a way that is similar to the original ancient Silk Road, which is it's a trading network that is not created or dominated by a single country, but it's it's a sort of a common good, an international, a multilateral project. And I think looking at it from this in this way would help Europe to find a good way to deal with this and to be more active and more involved and think of ways how Europe can also be a shaping influence together with China and other actors of this new Silk Road.
Do you expect any projects to happen where you are in the Netherlands?
For the Netherlands, we have the Netherlands now also has a direct train link with a Chinese city, with Chengdu in Sichuan province. And the number of direct trains is increasing. There's also increasing Chinese involvement in the port of Rotterdam, which is the largest seaport in the European Union. And Amsterdam Airport, Schiphol Airport, is the largest cargo hub for air freight between the European Union and China. That means that because of these reasons, there will be increasing also Chinese investors and companies coming to the Netherlands, wanting to do business here, and there will be more and more Dutch companies also responding to this. So I do expect there will be increasing Belt and Road related activities also in the Netherlands.
That's Frans-Paul van der Putten, who is a senior research fellow at the Kleindahl Institute in the Netherlands, talking with us as we continue our series on China's One Belt, One Road initiative all this week. Frans-Paul, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.
Last year, President Trump made a comment about abolitionist Frederick Douglass, saying he's done an amazing job. He seemed to imply that Douglass was still alive. Our next guests say the legacy of Frederick Douglass is very much alive. Nettie Washington Douglass is the great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass, and Ken Morris is her son. They co-founded the Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives, which is celebrating the birth of the former slave and abolitionist 200 years ago. Nettie, let's start off with you. Frederick Douglass wrote his autobiography in the mid-1800s. That was just before the Civil War when he did it. Today, we see white supremacists marching in the streets of the United States. How was Frederick Douglass able to wage the fight for civil rights, and how might that be instructive to us today?
I asked the same question, and I don't have a specific answer, so I just have to assume that it was just God's will. I often say, how did Frederick Douglass do anything? I think of him as an orphan child, an abandoned child. His mother died when he was just a few years old, and at the age of six, his grandmother, what I call, walked him into his life of slavery. And from that point forward, he was totally on his own. So I'm amazed that he accomplished anything.
What do you mean, walked him into his life of slavery?
Oh, well, he and his grandmother every Sunday took a walk. It was his grandmother's responsibility on the plantation to raise the babies until they were old enough to go to their respective plantations. And this particular Sunday, they took their normal walk, except they walked 12 miles, and then they got to the road to the plantation, which was a mile from the road up to the house. So that final mile is what I call his grandmother walking him into his life of slavery. I took that walk myself, and it was extremely emotional. And as a grandmother myself, what she said to him, she knew that she would never see him again. He did not know that this was the last time he'd see his grandmother. And tears flowed down my cheeks as I took that walk. But I was determined to do it because I just tried to put myself in her place. What did she say to him? What words of encouragement did she say to him? I'll never know. But from my perspective, as a mother and a grandmother, it was a very, very difficult time.
And when you consider that this was a young boy who never knew who his father was, it was presumed that his father was his master. He had siblings, as Mom said, but they were like strangers to him. And now that he is truly alone on the plantation, you have a boy that had no family, he had no home, and he had no country. But in spite of all of that, he was able to rise up from slavery and to go on to positively affect the lives of millions of people. So to, you know, think about what he would be doing today in the climate of racist carrying tiki torches. And I believe if he were here today, he would be agitating. That's what he always talked about, was to agitate.
So with a legacy like that of Frederick Douglass, how do you do justice to it right now? What are you doing with the organization to mark the bicentennial and also to carry on his legacy?
The Frederick Douglass Family Initiatives has reprinted his narrative, added some family pictures to it, and we have students that have written paragraphs explaining what the narrative meant to them, reading it, and it's just been an incredible book. But on the cover, it's an extra special picture. It's a painting, a drawing that was done by my grandfather, Joseph Douglass, and we have that picture. Has never been printed before on the cover of the what we hope will be a million books that we will be distributing to students across the country.
And what is, aside from the publication, what is your main focus right now?
The work that we do, what I call our day job, is human trafficking prevention education in the classroom and training of educators. When we were looking to do this work, we looked at the legacy of Frederick Douglass, who was my great-great-great-grandfather, and then also Booker T. Washington, who is my great-great-grandfather.
Good so blood, Ken.
Well, it comes from my mother, so just take away one great, right, and you'll have her greats.
Even
and, you know,
better
by the
blood,
way,
Eddie.
Better blood. Actually, you bring up a great point when you talk about all of those greats. It does make me feel very far removed, but we always like to talk about a story about my great-grandmother, Fanny Douglass, who lived to be 103 years old, and she met Frederick Douglass when she was a little girl. And my Aunt Portia, to whom I was very close as well, lived to be 95, and she was Booker T. Washington's daughter. My great-grandmother would tell me firsthand stories about the man she would call the man with the great big white hair. And my Aunt Portia would tell me stories about her father, Booker T. Washington. So even with all of those greats, I can say, or we can say, we stand one person away from history, one person away from slavery, and one person away from each man. And so we continue their legacies. We combined the legacy of the great abolitionist and Frederick Douglass and the great educator and Booker T. Washington, and the way we go about preventing human trafficking in communities is abolition through education.
Thank you so much. Much more to talk about, but it's been a pleasure. Thank you both to you, Nettie Washington Douglass, the great-great-granddaughter of Frederick Douglass, and Kenneth Morris as well, the great-great-great-grandson of Frederick Douglass. Thank you both. Nice to speak with you.
Thank you. Nice to say happy birthday, great-great-grandpa.
Thank you, Lisa.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.